From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Flint Mayor Karen Weaver ready to speak out for Hillary Clinton at the Democratic National Convention.
She was in constant communication. She has helped us put things in place. We know she is concerned about, you know, the infrastructure and water quality standards and what's going on in the city of Flint.
The little salsa company from Ferndale that made a big splash in the food world.
Market forces are moving in our direction. Local, genuine, authentic.
He's a genius on the autism spectrum. His message to employers, don't overlook people with autism.
We cannot waste these visionaries because these are the people who could actually help propel us into a whole different future.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. You know a good salsa when you taste it, but did you ever think about the people and the process behind the product?
To this day, we produce 85 tons of fresh salsa a day. 31% of all the fresh salsa in the United States is made right here in Metro Detroit, and we still make it in 5-gallon buckets.
The story of Michigan's garden fresh salsa and the sell-off to Campbell's in the new book, Irrational Persistence. That's later in the program. But first, Michigan is certainly going to have its place in the spotlight during this week's Democratic National Convention. Senator Gary Peters is co-chair of the convention. And among those who will be speaking to delegates this week in Philadelphia, former Governor Jennifer Granholm, Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan, and Flint Mayor Karen Weaver. She speaks on Wednesday night, and she is here with us now. Mayor Weaver, welcome back to Stateside.
Well, thank you. I am glad to be here.
Tell me, what are you thinking and feeling as you think about this week's convention, its place in U.S. history, where a woman is going to be nominated as the Democratic presidential candidate?
I know it. And it is just, you know, it's exciting. And one of the things we have to say is, you know, people have said, oh, are you voting for her because she's a woman? And it's no, she is the best candidate that happens to be a woman.
And the fact that you worked very closely with her to bring national attention to Flint's water crisis. So you know this woman in a way that many voters don't. And what is it that you want to say about her when you speak to the delegates and really to the country?
You know, one of the things I want to say is people have always asked that I believe that she was politicizing the issue of what was going on in Flint. And she has been with us every single step of the way. She has, you know, as soon as we declared the emergency, people started coming from her, you know, from her camp, from her headquarters. She was in constant communication. She has helped us put things in place. We know she is concerned about, you know, the infrastructure and water quality standards and what's going on in the city of Flint. And let me say not only in the city of Flint, because there are hundreds of Flints when you look at what's going on across the country as far as our failing infrastructure. And she knows this is something that has to be addressed. Environmental injustices is something that's high on her radar. So, you know, she's been with us every single step of the way.
And yet, as you know, I'm not telling you something you haven't heard, the way that Hillary Clinton and at the same time Donald Trump are the most disliked, disdained candidates that anyone can remember being together in the same election cycle. So we know well over half of voters say they don't like her, they don't trust her. You have spent time with this woman. You've worked with her.
Exactly.
Tell me,
what surprises me, because, you know, I have found her to be very, very genuine. Like I said, everything we've talked about and everything she said she was going to do as far as, you know, helping with Flint, she has come through. When I talked with her about, you know, the National Guard getting paid $2 million to distribute water, I said, and we're in a city where we need to be part of the healing process and taking care of ourselves. And we've got young people between the ages of 16 and 24 that aren't in school and aren't employed, and we could be putting them to work, having them do the water distribution, having them do the food delivery, and also pairing them up with the plumbers and the pipe fitters that are helping with the lead service line removal. And we put that program in place where they're going to be in an apprenticeship doing this and getting trained that, you know, we hope they stay in Flint, but wherever they go, they will have a skill that no one can take from them. She was very instrumental in putting that Flint Waterworks program together. She was the one that said, we need to have one of the debates in Flint and highlight not only the tragedy that has taken place here, but also let's show some of the positive things that are going on in Flint as well, and keeping us on the map and keeping our story out there. So I found her to be a very honest and genuine person.
And we know that tonight's theme is United Together. And yet, as we speak, we know there is a lot of chaos right now for the Democrats, with the dirty laundry being really hung out for everyone to see, with the email leak showing that top DNC officials were kicking around ways to hurt Bernie Sanders, and DNC Chair Debbie Wasserman Schultz is stepping down over all of this. Is there a sense that the Democratic Party is yet to be truly united behind Hillary Clinton? Do we still have a way to go to get there?
Well, you know, I certainly hope not. I just left. Ben Jealous was speaking at the Black Caucus, and he was, you know, a big Bernie supporter. And he said he was very happy that we were coming together, and he was happy to support, you know, Bernie Sanders, saying, yes, Hillary is the candidate. That's who we need to get behind. And so that's what we want to have happen.
It does seem that efforts to give the people in your city, the people of Flint, safe drinking water, it kind of feels like those efforts have plateaued, no?
Well, you know, things should have happened much, much sooner. And that's one of the things that I've been talking about, is while things are happening, they haven't happened quickly enough. We should not be entering year three with this issue of not being able to turn on our taps and drink clean water. So we are starting with the lead service line replacement. But this is something that we should not have had to wait, you know, this amount of time.
Is there any new progress to tell us about while we've got you with us?
Well, like I said, one of the things we had done not too long ago was we put out the proposal so we could get companies working on, you know, removing these lead service lines. So that has happened, and they should be starting. I'm hoping that it's starting this week. It's something that was long overdue, so that's going forward. I'm hoping that we're going to have some business investments coming to the city of Flint. And that's all I want to share right now.
Yeah.
I want to wait. But there are some positive things that are going to be happening for our city.
And I think overall, do you think that you're being in the national spotlight this week, standing there, you know, speaking to the Democratic Convention, you think that might help jumpstart things toward your goal of getting safe drinking water for everybody in Flint?
I don't see how it wouldn't help with that. You know, and that's something that we've greatly, greatly appreciated, is Hillary Clinton and others that helped keep our story out there. Because one of the things the people of Flint have always been scared of is that the story would go away before we got this issue resolved. And so for them, you know, for her to help us with this story and keep it out there like this is just a wonderful, wonderful thing. Because like I said, there are hundreds of Flints all across the country.
Flint Mayor Karen Weaver, who will be speaking this week at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. Mayor Weaver, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
There are some Michiganders in Philadelphia this week who hope to change the all but certain outcome. Michigan Radio's Steve Carmody reports.
A ragtag caravan of cars, vans, and campers rolled into the Parvin State Park campground in southern New Jersey just after 10 o'clock Saturday night. Almost immediately, a group of Bernie Sanders supporters picked up guitars and started singing. This campground in southern New Jersey is about as far from Philadelphia as the Sanders supporters are from voting for Hillary Clinton in November. Michael Eads is from Madison Heights, Michigan. He's volunteered for the Sanders campaign in six states, and he's not giving up yet.
I mean, naturally, we all really, really want Bernie to win. Failing that, the reason that we're here is to let the Democratic Party know that we noticed the shenanigans that they've been pulling as far as being unfair and impartial during the election, and we're not very happy about that. So at the very least, we'd like to send a message that we noticed and we're not happy.
Internal party emails leaked to the news media last week showed top Democratic Party officials wanted to undermine the Sanders campaign. Sunday, Florida Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz announced she would step down as Democratic National Committee chairwoman. Meanwhile, by Sunday afternoon, the peace and love at the Sanders campground changed to a very different emotion on the streets of Philadelphia.
This is our revolution! Show me what democracy looks like!
The anger on the part of Bernie Sanders' most loyal supporters is a problem for Hillary Clinton, who will need their votes in November. But one woman's problem is another woman's opportunity. Green Party presidential nominee Jill Stein is in Philly, stumping for votes among disgruntled Sanders supporters.
Why in the world would you continue this revolution, so-called, inside of a party that has worked very hard in a very underhanded and vicious way to destroy this revolution? What makes you think there is any future for the revolution inside of that party.
But one prominent Michigan political scientist has his doubts that many Sanders supporters will bolt the Democratic Party for the Green or another third party in November. Vincent Hutchins is a research professor in the Center for Political Studies at the University of Michigan.
Historically, we found, political scientists have found that, with some notable exceptions, when there are these tough primary fights, at the end of the day, the supporters of the losing candidate come home. That is to say, they support the nominee.
But Sanders supporter Michael Eade says the 2016 presidential election could be one of those exceptions.
If all these people who have noticed the corruption in this primary go and roll over and vote for Hillary Clinton once again, you know, where does it end? We just allow this type of stuff that, you know, the party will just know that they can manage the primary, elect who they like, and we'll just roll over and vote for them? No. Vote with your conscience.
Democrats may take steps this week to heal the divisions with Sanders supporters, but they shouldn't expect the healing to be complete by the end of the week. Reporting from the Democratic National Convention, I'm Steve Carmody in Philadelphia.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When you have a question, where do you turn? Don Williams turned to our Am I Curious project.
Am I curious?
Am I curious?
Am I curious?
You ask a question, the public votes, and we investigate the winning question. Don Williams is from Holland. He wanted to know why mental health resources vary so widely across the state.
I have friends, close friends I know who are mentally ill. And I have in my coffee group a county commissioner well informed in this issue. And we often discussed it. And I soon became aware that the funding for mental health issues and mental health in general was uneven, rather chaotic. And I decided that I'd pose this question and see if I was right.
He is right. The kind of mental health treatment you might get in Washtenaw County is quite different from what you would see, let's say, in Lake County. Why is this? Bob Sheehan can answer this question. He's the CEO of the Michigan Association of Community Mental Health Boards. Bob, has there always been this discrepancy between counties?
There's been this discrepancy for about 30 years. It's shrinking. I should tell you, it is shrinking. The state's making incredible efforts to shrink the financing for Medicaid and non-Medicaid financing across the state, but it's still a long way to go.
Well, what do we need to understand in order to wrap our heads around why the quality and availability of mental health services varies so widely from county to county in our state?
Sure. So I think if you were to build the system today, just start out with, it's a $3 billion system, by the way, so there's a significant amount of money. If you build it today, you'd say, what does everybody in the state need? Let's build a uniform treatment and services delivery platform across the state. That's not how it was built. It was built based on where state hospitals were located, because you may remember, but when we closed state hospitals, a lot of those employees or the money for those employees went to the local CMHs around those state hospitals. So if you lived in a town with a state mental hospital, the CMH was funded better from then on. Secondly, depending on where the appropriations chair lived, I have to tell you that some appropriations chairs brought money home in the mental health system. Some did not. Some believed it was a state utility financing that should be spread out, but some brought it home. And then thirdly, it was based on how aggressively a CMH billed Medicaid. Medicaid wasn't billed till the early 80s, and some CMHs said, let's bill this and see how this goes, and some did not. And so what you ended up in 97, though, that became frozen. So we're talking about 20 years now. It became frozen under a financing system that hasn't modified much except for the last few years. There has been some movement, I should tell you. I want to applaud the state. But it's hard politically. If you don't add money to the system, you end up having to cut the better funded to fund the more poorly funded. I don't think that's the way to do it, by the way. Our system doesn't think that. But that's what we're trying to do, and that's a political hard ball to roll up the hill.
It reminds me of my mother's old saying, having to borrow from Peter to pay Paul.
That's exactly. And, you know, if Peter has the money, Peter's saying, over my dead body, I'm not going to let that money move. And that makes sense because, you know, if you think about it, they're using it to serve people. In fact, what I've been telling people, Cynthia, is if the services in a certain county that's well-funded are inappropriate, they never should have been funded, but they're not inappropriate. It's what people expect in that community and actually what should be allowed statewide. So we've been pushing to say, don't cut the mountaintops to fund the valleys. Fund the valleys by taking new money and moving it up to the mountaintop level, which is what most people expect. Unfortunately, that's not happening. So over the next year, you will see cries across some parts of the state when the cuts happen that'll even things out. But that's, in my mind, not the way you achieve equity.
Bob, can outside agencies, let's i.e. Medicaid, do they have the capacity to step up and replace lost funding when municipalities, for instance, Wayne County, have to cut funding because of revenue losses?
That's a great question. So Medicaid can't. It can't be used that way. State funding can. Medicaid, because it's paid on a per enrollee. So if I'm enrolled in Medicaid, my CMH gets so many dollars per month to serve me. That can't be used that way. There are some adjustments you can make, but because Medicaid is already based on poverty, that the poverty index is already built in, that if a town or a county doesn't have the kind of financing, there's nothing Medicaid can do. The state can do that. The state can go in and say, we'll use state money to close up economically stressed cities' gaps, but only state dollars can do that.
What role do the private providers, the ones contracted to provide services, what role do they play in determining levels of service for patients? I mean, I'm wondering, can we look at the quality of these private services available as one reason for the discrepancy?
You know, that doesn't tend to drive it. The providers across the state, and sometimes they're CMHs, the public providers, sometimes they're privates, are really top-notch. When we look across the country, Michigan's got one of the best services because of its breadth and its depth and what we require that a clinician have, the credentials. So it tends not to be that. It might be experience, though. So if you live in a community in which there was a lot of money and your clinicians became really skilled in certain areas, right down the street in a county without that kind of financing, your clinicians wouldn't have the experience to gain that. So it's just they haven't had the chance to use those kind of techniques because they can't afford them. So it's not that you know, fundamentally they're different in terms of skill level. They're different in terms of experience level because they haven't had the resources to apply that clinical expertise.
How about overhead and management? I mean, can we look at the variance in efficiency and effectiveness as in the way that mental health services are managed regionally in this state as a reason for why quality varies? I mean, in other words, if every provider were equally efficient, would every patient receive the same level of services?
It is a variable, but it's small. So, for example, the average administration of CMHs across the state is 6%. I should tell you, that's really low for healthcare. Healthcare, it tends to be closer to 15%. So that's low already. And even if you cut that in half, you'd have 3% more dollars. The disparities are large. The disparities are two or threefold, so 200 or 300% difference. So making a 3% difference because you cut administration wouldn't move the ball very far. What you would need is large-scale changes in financing.
Bob, you're part of this large working group exploring different options for funding mental health services in Michigan. Is this discrepancy in the quality of services across the state one of the topics the work group is digging into and trying to address?
It is, you bet. And because advocates and consumers feel this, they realize, you know, someone will say, I have a cousin who in a different county is getting A, B, and C, and I'm getting, you know, far less care. And it's not so much quality, I must admit. It's quantity or timeliness, you know. Someone might say, I'm getting 4 hours of care a day or a week or a month, and my cousin's getting 20. So that can't be right. And that's all finance. So, yes, it's a big push. There is a manual the state puts out. It's a Medicaid manual. It applies, by the way, to non-Medicaid services, too. We all have to follow it. And people do, up to the level of the financing that's allowed. But advocates and consumers, they have a list of issues. This is up towards the top, more uniform treatment available across the state.
Are there states providing models for doing all of this better than we do in Michigan?
You know, it's funny you'd say that. Our association works with a lot of consulting firms, and they're helping us see there's lots of models across the country that we can draw on. There's no one model that is proven better than others. Those that tend to have a broad array of services like Michigan do well. Those that are community-based do well. Michigan's that way. Those, though, that work on healthcare integration, and Michigan started that in the last 5 or 6 years, where you bring in primary care. So, for example, if a consumer, we call our patients consumers. If a consumer walks into a CMH and says, I also have diabetes or COPD, that CMH can link them up quickly to a provider and stabilize their care. Because a lot of behavioral health care needs, especially chronic ones, are also linked to chronic health care conditions. If you can treat the two simultaneously, you can bring it around. So there's some great models across the state, New York, Minnesota, Massachusetts, California, that we're going to be drawing on.
Bob Sheehan is the CEO of the Michigan Association of Community Mental Health Boards. Thanks so much for helping us with MI Curious, Bob.
Thank you.
Okay, Bob Sheehan gave his answer to Don Williams' question. We decided to check in with Don to see if we answered that question.
Oh, you answered my question well, and I thought this whole exercise was very worthwhile.
So what question do you have for our MI Curious project? The project is powered by you. So go to MichiganRadio.org and share that thing that you've always been curious about.
the best and the brightest.
Opportunities, the next idea.
We're going to find that these social and cultural factors really add a lot to economic growth.
Albert Einstein, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, Charles Darwin, Dan Aykroyd, Sir Isaac Newton. What links them together? All are on the autism spectrum, which proves the point. People on the autism spectrum have much to offer in the workplace. Yet, some 90% of adults with autism in this country are underemployed or they're not working at all. Our latest contributor to The Next Idea believes that Michigan's losing out by not tapping into this resource, the community of men and women who are on the autism spectrum. Jeffrey Allen Ford is an author in East Lansing. He's a member of Mensa. In fact, the World Genius Directory named him the 2016 Genius of the Year for America. Jeffrey Ford has Asperger's syndrome and Mobius syndrome. Jeffrey, welcome.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be on your show.
Tell us, what is Asperger's and Mobius syndrome?
Asperger's syndrome is something that affects a person's social skills. It can cause sensory impairments. For example, I have a problem with sounds. Hallways in schools, hallways in shopping malls completely disorient me. And basically, the commonality with everybody with Asperger's is a social impairment, and that's what we struggle with the most.
And what about Mobius syndrome?
Mobius syndrome affects the 6th and 7th cranial nerves, and that causes visual difficulties, and it also causes facial paralysis. For me, the way that manifests is I'm completely unable to drive a car. Nobody wants to see me on the road. I would be known as dangerous. The other thing with the facial paralysis, when I was younger, I had to speak only one syllable at a time because my face, I couldn't coordinate the words with the thoughts in my head. It took many years. I was still in speech therapy during my first year of college. So it's been a lifelong challenge.
Jeffrey, I watched a video of a marvelous TED Talk that you gave this past March, and something really struck me. You said in the talk, as a kid, you hated how you were different from everyone else, and now you celebrate it. And I'm wondering what or who happened to help you make that shift?
Wonderful, wonderful question. What happened was many different people came into my life. When I was a child, you're stuck inside of a closed system, inside of a school building. A lot of times, the children you go to school with make up their minds about you in kindergarten, the first grade, and it's hard to break out of that. When I became an adult, I went out, and there's a whole big world out there, and I met so many other very unique people from different countries, and a lot of people were very open to who I am. And people who accept your differences tend to help to amplify the positive differences that you possess. Also, I did a lot of reading, and that helped too, because a lot of the great people in the world are people who are significantly different than other people, and that's what makes them special. If they were just like everybody else, we wouldn't talk about them. We wouldn't be watching them on TMZ. You really have to be different in a way to stand out and be great. When I used to try to be like everybody else, I failed miserably, and honestly, I often made a complete fool of myself. But once I started to accept how different I am and shared that, I'm also a writer. I've been read by millions of people, been on the cover of National Writing Magazine, and other people, my story resonates with them because my story is their story too. Nobody has ever reached the top of their profession by thinking and doing things exactly like everybody else. You have to think and do things a little bit different. And we never, ever fall in love with someone because that person reminded you of everybody else you ever met in your life. We fall in love with people because they're different. Once I learned to accept my differences, then I was open to have love come into my life, to have true relationships. And we have to by the way, people with Asperger's and people with autism, if when they're younger, what we do is we teach them that, okay, you need to socialize and behave like everybody else. And there's a big push to educate people to assimilate. And it's good to do that because you want people to have that choice about how they're going to get along into society or not. But if children with autism are taught to role play through life, they will never have a genuine relationship. And you'll make them ashamed of who they truly are. Mm-hmm. And it was by accepting my differences that really allowed a whole new world to open up to me. And by doing that, it didn't just stop with me. I've been able to affect millions of other people, and that is a life worth living, not being ashamed of who I am.
We've certainly seen autism awareness and acceptance change in the past decade. And to that point, your essay for The Next Idea about what people on the autism spectrum could bring to workplaces in Michigan. Give us some examples.
Well, people on the autism spectrum, especially the higher functioning people with autism, they are excellent in the STEM careers, the science, technology, engineering, and math. They're also often very good with music. They're in entertainment. So they can really contribute that way. Now, people with lower functioning autism, they have a lot to offer, too, because both people on the higher end and lower end, we enjoy repetitive activities. We enjoy routine. It helps to make us very dependable. And statistically, we are seen as more dependable, more loyal, more honest, and more trustworthy. Those are great, great attributes to have as an employee and really in all relationships.
So you really believe Michigan's autistic citizens have a lot that they can do to benefit the state and its economy?
Oh, I know that they can. There's no question about that. And it's such a shame because it's an untapped resource because 90% are either unemployed or underemployed. We're in a whole different economy now. It's a global economy. We're not just competing with the town next to us or even with the rest of the state or the rest of the country. We're competing with people all over the world. We cannot waste a single human being. We can't. We have to tap into this resource. And some of the most intelligent people who ever lived, Einstein, Michelangelo, Mozart, Thomas Jefferson, Sir Isaac Newton, Charles Darwin, are all seen by psychological experts now to have had autism. We cannot waste these visionaries because these are the people who could actually help propel us into a whole different future if only we'll listen and take the time to see what they have to say. A lot of people with autism, myself included, we might not be the life of the party or the best person at the water cooler in terms of who a lot of people might want to associate with. And some of us are. Some of us are. But just because people have social issues doesn't mean that we also don't bring a lot to the workplace.
Jeffrey Ford is an author, a speaker, and the World Genius Directory's 2016 Genius of the Year for America. His essay, and you do want to read this essay, it's great. It's at the Next Idea page at michiganradio.org. Jeffrey Ford, it was great to talk with you. We want to thank you for being a part of the Next Idea.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Support for the Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. You might not know his name, but it's a pretty good bet you've seen his products in your grocery store or you're a fan of his salsa and chips. Dave Zilko is the former vice chairman of Garden Fresh Gourmet. He and business partners Jack and Annette Aronson took a scrappy little Oakland County company deep in debt and turned it into the number one brand of fresh salsa in North America, with revenues topping $100 million. A year ago, Garden Fresh was sold to Campbell Soup Company for some $231 million. It's a success story offering wisdom and lessons to other Michigan business owners and entrepreneurs. Dave tells the story of Garden Fresh in his new book, Irrational Persistence, 7 Secrets That Turned a Bankrupt Startup into a $231 million Business. Good to have you with us, Dave Zilko.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here. I really am.
There were such big headlines when you and the Aronsons sold Garden Fresh last year to Campbell, and I'm sure people were looking going, oh, yeah, must be nice, having no idea that this didn't just happen, that you all started not just from nothing, but as you say in your book, less than nothing. How deep in the hole were you?
Well, I founded my first specialty food company on my girlfriend's $2,500 credit card loan, and I did it because I got turned down for it. I was so broke at the time. I labored for 11 years, what I refer to as my lost decade. I was easily $350,000 in debt that I'll admit to. You know, I tell people I'm glad my wife doesn't read what I gave her to sign. Just
because, yes, the girlfriend became the wife.
The girlfriend, yeah, yes. People ask all the time. I did marry her,
yes.
And we're still married to this day. In fact, she calls it the best investment she ever made.
Well,
so,
there you go.
Yeah, there you go.
You were hand bottling. And you were packing pallets and hauling them out to the trucks yourself. So this was
in a little kitchen with no heat. Mm-hmm. I bought a mustard company. Then for the next 5 years, I'm breaking eggs every day at 5:30 in the morning. So one day I find myself in New York at a food show, and I introduce myself to Jack Aronson. Now, Jack Aronson, a few years before then, was in the back of a bankrupt restaurant in Ferndale, Michigan, 8.5 in Woodward. He was $450,000 in debt that he'll admit to. He was taking the bus to work from Waterford because he got his car repossessed. He had to declare bankruptcy to hold on to his lease, and literally to help pay his electric bill, out of desperation, he pulls out a 5-gallon bucket, and in 15 minutes, his first shot makes what is today Garden Fresh's artichoke garlic salsa. So he's struggling for a few more years. When I met him in New York, he got back and he had just built a new plant. He overbuilt. He invited me to become his partner. The plant was like $1.6 million to build. So we were literally in a multi-million dollar hole when we started.
Uh-uh.
Our goal was to get the company to $10 million one day. We knew it would be a lot of work and everything, but we thought, all right, this would be a nice life for ourselves if we can do this. We eventually got to $110 million, and then Campbell's reached out to us, and we sold for almost $250 million.
When you stop and think about what you were describing, it's so easy to think of this, you know, little company making its fresh salsa and facing debt and trying to grow, and then ending with, well, it was a good, worthy effort, but it's over. Now what do we do? It's very easy to see that. Instead, as you say, sold for some $250 million. To Campbell. So why did your story have this super successful ending?
It's my biggest surprises were how long this took and how hard it was, which is why I named the book Irrational Persistence, because mm-hmm. what we did made no sense. I mean, salsa from Detroit, I remember being in Los Angeles meeting with a buyer from Costco who eventually became our largest customer. I swear to God, the guy's name was Paul Newman. So I'm in LA meeting with Paul Newman, and he's looking at our salsa and he goes, this is the best packaging I've ever seen. And he tried, he goes, this is the best salsa I've ever had in my life. And he looked at the label and he goes, you're from Detroit? He goes, what'd you do? Get lost coming out of Texas? He goes, I get 100 fresh salsa companies coming in here through a year. You know, they're all from the Southern California, Texas. You're supposed to be moving cars in Michigan. Mm-hmm. Nobody makes salsa from Detroit. So what we were doing from the get-go was irrational to begin with. And it was a long, hard road, longer and harder than we thought. But we really believed in our product, and we decided to adopt a standard that as long as we were the best product on the market, the best product we could possibly make, there was going to be a place for us in this world. And even though we were a salsa company from Detroit, as irrational as that is, we just stuck to this guiding light, this North Star, that as long as we were the best, there was going to be a place for us in this world. And in the end, it all worked out.
In your book, you break down the ingredients of your success story, and you start with your challenge to entrepreneurs and business owners. And here's what you say, summon the courage to enter the dark room. What's that mean?
First of all, what drives people to be entrepreneurs? You know, for me, there was a gap between the level at which I was living my life and the level at which I wanted to live my life. And that void was driving me crazy. It was just unacceptable to me. What drives an entrepreneur? For me, it was to alleviate that void. So if you come up with an idea for a product, a service, a business, it's one thing to have an idea. It's another thing to move forward with it. So I liken it to standing in front of a room and the door opens and it's completely void of light, just complete and utter darkness. And who wants to go into a dark room? Dark rooms are frightening. You've got to really be comfortable with ambiguity. Most people, the rational person, is going to walk away and just stay in the comfort of their relative job and maybe stay in the rut they're in. The irrational person, which in my experience is what most entrepreneurs are, will enter in that room. The door's going to close behind you and you're in utter darkness. And it's a really hard thing to do. Now, when you're in there, you've got to look for sources of light. And you're going to maybe find a little nightlight. Maybe you'll find a window shade or something. Eventually, the room is going to be illuminated. You're going to figure it out. You're going to be able to navigate your way around so that you can at least make a living. But if you want to grow your business, there's going to be another door leading into an even darker, bigger room. And you keep going and going and going. And it really becomes a way of life. My partner, Jake Anderson, who founded Garden Fresh, we walked into many dark rooms. We're still walking into dark rooms today. And the fear is still there. But it really does take courage to take that first step.
You also offer what I thought was very startling advice. Never sell anything. Say what?
Yeah. I was responsible for sales and strategy for Garden Fresh, and Jack was responsible for operations and strategy. And I tell people all the time, I never sold a thing. I would just simply have conversations with people. My goal is to form a strategic partnership with somebody. If I couldn't meet their needs to a better extent than any of my competitors, I would literally walk out. I never felt pressure to make a sale. I never cared. We literally developed this approach to not only selling but building our company. One of my chapters in my book is called Build a Company That Woody Allen Would Be Proud Of. And Woody Allen has this famous saying, 80% of success in life is showing up. And to me, we took a specific approach to layer in so many strategic advantages to our program that our competitors couldn't match, that our sales force, that all they had to do was simply show up to be successful. I tell people all the time, building a great company is not just developing great products. You've got to develop a great company, too. You've got to take a strategic approach to building your company so that all your sales force has to do is show up to be successful so they never have to sell anything.
I'm talking with Dave Zilko, the former vice chairman of Garden Fresh, and his book is Irrational Persistence, 7 Secrets That Turned a Bankrupt Startup into a $231 million business. Start thinking of companies that start out, success comes their way. They grow, they expand, and then too big, it becomes a downward spiral and they collapse. How did Garden Fresh avoid that pitfall?
We avoided it primarily by our absolute commitment to quality. When Jack Aronson founded this in the back of his clubhouse barbecue, bankrupt clubhouse barbecue, by pulling out a 5-gallon bucket to pay his electric bill, he peeled onions by hand. We kept doing that, even into our big 25,000-square-foot factory. So then I came up with the idea that I'm running all over the country. I'm saying we've got the best flavor profile in the United States. I think we can become the number one brand of fresh salsa in this country. And I ran our board meetings, and our board was saying, you're crazy. This is never going to happen. We were about a $30 million company. I said, I think we'd be a $70 million company. And Jack said, well, let's go for it. If Dave thinks we do it, let's go for it. But if we're going to scale national, we can't be making salsa in 5-gallon buckets. So we brought in these process engineers, and they said the same thing. If you're going to go big time, you got to buy these big tanks. You got to be like Big Food. So we bought these 600-gallon tanks. And for months, we tried to get our salsa to taste the way it did when we're making in these 5-gallon buckets. And we just couldn't do it. The onions were floating to the bottom. The consistency was different. So Jack said, and I know it sounds like cliche, he goes, look, I don't care if we're the biggest. I just want to be the best. So we got rid of the tanks and we reverted back to our 5-gallon buckets. To this day, we produce 85 tons of fresh salsa a day. 31% of all the fresh salsa in the United States is made right here in Metro Detroit. And we still make it in 5-gallon buckets. And Jack said something to me really poignant a couple years ago. He said, the proudest thing I am of Garden Fresh is that the salsa we're making today is the exact recipe I made in the back of that bankrupt restaurant in 15 minutes on my first shot. We haven't changed a thing. We peel onions by hand. We wash our cilantro 3 times. We still make it in 5-gallon buckets. Now, on the back end, we've got these automated filling machines. They're world class. But on the front end, we still make it in micro batches, literally by hand, just like he did in the back of that restaurant.
There were other corporate suitors. Why was Campbell's the right one?
In 2008, a division of Nestle, which happens to be the largest food company in the world, made an offer to purchase us. The next year, Pepsi, which is the largest food company in this country, made an offer to purchase us. And in both instances, the executives, and I kind of handled the deals for us, the executives came to me and said, if you sell to us, you're going to be so proud of what we do with your company. We see you guys making the stuff in 5-gallon buckets because we know you don't have a big capital, you know, expenditure budget. We're going to turn you into Big Food, and we are going to start making it in big tanks, and you're going to be so proud of what we turn this company into. And I was offended by that because by this time, the 5-gallon bucket was a source of pride for me. It was a badge of honor.
And they were dissing it.
they were dissing it. And we had already tried the big tank route. And I knew there was no way they could replicate our flavor profile, which I knew was the best in the world with big tanks. So I was actually speaking at an investment banking conference in New York. And the guy who came after me was the VP of M&A for Campbell's. He reached out to me a few months later and said, you know, tactfully, are you guys for sale? And I said, we're really not. And he goes, well, will you go out and meet some people running one of our divisions in Southern California in Santa Monica? So I said, sure. And to show you how motivated to sell I was, I waited 5 months before I saw him. I went there. I do this all the time. I thought it was going to be a five-minute meet and greet. I connected with these guys instantly. And I said, look, do you have time for a presentation? So I pulled up my laptop, set it up, and I put on a full-blown Garden Fresh presentation. How we make it, we peel onions by hand. We make it in five-gallon buckets. And at the very end of the presentation, their president and CEO of Bolthouse Farms, his name is Jeff Dunn, the first thing he says to me, he goes, I love those five-gallon buckets. He goes, you guys are the future of food. He goes, you got to make things in small processes, micro-batch it, by hand, and then you figure out how to scale nationally, internationally. By this time, we were shipping to Europe and Asia. And he goes, you guys are the future food. You guys have figured this out. And I walked out of that meeting on the streets of Santa Monica, and I said, these are the people we're selling Garden Fresh to. I didn't even tell Jack and his wife Annette that I was meeting with them. I'd met, these things happen so much all the time. They didn't even know about it. And I said, these are the people we're selling Garden Fresh to. So that's how I knew they were the right people. When he told me, I respect the way you're making it. We're not changing a thing. You've got to put the best product possible out and then worry about everything else from there.
And keeping jobs and operations in Michigan was very important to you.
It was
very
important.
Talk about that.
Some of our previous suitors were going to move us to the East Coast. Jack grew up in Ferndale, and he used to deliver newspapers in our neighborhood. So the place means the world to him, the absolute world to him. Somebody was going to move us to the East Coast. And when Jack was trying to get Garden Fresh off the ground, he had to go before the Ferndale City Council to get his zoning change for his first plant that he wanted to open. And he was going to move it into a video store. He had to change the zoning from commercial to industrial, and the vote was 5-4 against. So Jack gets up, he's thinking quick on his feet, and he goes to the microphone, and he says, I tell you what, I will put a sign in the window saying public welcome, and I'll set up a card table inside my salsa plant, and I will sell pints of salsa for $2.50 to anybody that walks in. And one of the city council members says, you know what, I got a good feeling about you, I'm going to take a chance on you, flip this vote. So I went from 5-4 against to 5-4 in favor. Fast forward today, Garden Fresh has 453 employees. We're by far the largest employer in Ferndale. I don't know who the city council member is, but I think they should erect a statue in front him in front of City Hall, because one guy took a chance on this one bankrupt restaurateur, and look what happened. So Ferndale's very near and dear to our hearts. It was very important to us that the company would never move from Detroit.
Dave, you've achieved that big business success with Garden Fresh Gourmet, and now you're helping other businesses through being an operating partner with Huron Capital. You're the CEO of Fuel Leadership. You're on the board of the Grow Michigan Venture Fund, among many other activities. Is this a promising time, do you think, for Michigan startups and for entrepreneurs?
I personally believe it does. I think one of the great things that Governor Snyder has done, which he doesn't get enough credit for, is I think he has created a terrific business environment in this state in general by limiting the single business tax and things like that. I think we're much more competitive than we were 5, 6, 7 years ago. That's for business in general. For food in particular, I think this is an incredible time to be a food entrepreneur simply because market forces are moving in our direction. Local, genuine, authentic, that is what the public is clamoring for. You see it in so many ways. You go to a restaurant, they have farm to table. You look at the craft beer industry. We had some association through our – we did a licensing deal with Margaritaville. We had some association with Anheuser-Busch. Budweiser beer, for the past 23 consecutive years, they have lost market share. You think of all the resources, all the money, all the talent they have at their disposal. They cannot reverse their market share losses because people are going to the craft beer movement. People want things made in their neighborhood by artisans, small batches, by hand. So a food entrepreneur can start with nothing or even less than nothing like we did. And the public is looking for artisanal, handcrafted, genuine, authentic products. So market forces are truly moving in the direction of food entrepreneurs to an extent that I don't think it has in the past 100 years in this country. I really don't. So you couple the business environment in Michigan with what's going on in the food industry, it's a great time to be a food entrepreneur.
What's the biggest thing you would change now, whether it's a policy level or whatever it would be, to make Michigan's business ecosystem even stronger and healthier?
You know, I would hope that I think legally in terms of regulatory practices, we're there. I would really hope that the angel investment community could rise to whatever level they could. And it's already fairly active, but there's so many people out there with great ideas. And I think mentoring is critical. One of the reasons why I wrote this book was, you know, I kind of had a lost decade before I met Jack. Jack had a couple lost decades before he met me. It took us a decade on top of that to build Garden Fresh. I share these seven secrets that we learned along the way. If I would have known these when I started, I could have saved a big part of that lost decade. So I think mentoring, angel investing, but I think the environment is there. And especially for food entrepreneurs, it's never been a better time.
Dave Zilko is the former vice chairman of Garden Fresh, and his book is Irrational Persistence, Seven Secrets That Turned a Bankrupt Startup into a $231 million Business. Thank you so much for sharing your story and your advice for all the hardworking entrepreneurs in Michigan.
Thank you. It was a thrill for me to be here. It really is.
And now, a minute with Mike.
I was recently on the World Wide Webs and came across a fairly funny vanity license plate. It had a star-spangled banner Upper Peninsula and a caption that read, "American by birth, Youper by the grace of God." Funny enough for a 77 Ford Granada, but I won't be screwing that onto my bumper anytime soon. But that plate got me thinking. Youper is the universal, unofficial term for our fellow Michiganers in the Upper Peninsula. But what about us in the Lower Peninsula? Why are we missing out on a peculiar peninsular pet name? I mean, what are we called, or what do Youpers call us? If you ask around, you might get a not-so-funny but trying-to-be-funny response that those living in the Lower Peninsula are referred to as trolls, because we're below the Mackinac Bridge. You get it? Yeah, my thoughts exactly. The thing is, Lower Peninsula people live south of the bridge. Not under it, so it doesn't really fit, and I'm willing to bet a Muskegon nickel that Youpers never use the term. So I asked native Youper Stieg Emblad for verification. Hey, Stieg, is troll regularly used by Youpers in reference to those in the Lower Peninsula?
No, people don't actually really use it. Some people will use it, but it's not a regular thing.
So that got me thinking, what would be an appropriate term for people in the Lower Peninsula? Lopers? LPers? Elpers, flatlanders, coney eaters, vowel slicers, tax dollar wasters, Lions fans, fudgies? I don't know. Well, Youper Stieg says,
we refer to them as people from downstate.
And thus, that would mean Lower Peninsula people would be downers. Which is kind of appropriate after you hear some of the news stories and political bloviations emanating from Michigan's Lower Peninsula. I mean, how could leaving the beautiful, naturific Upper Peninsula be anything but a downer?
And that's our program for today. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lynn Stroth. Our engineer today was Rusty Brock. Contributors are Melissa Benmark, Ellie Billings, Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.